We're talking about reproductive technologies. So last couple of weeks, I think maybe it's just last week, we talked about artificial insemination, and we talked about what its role is. If you got a handout, I think we got through maybe the first four pages there. And we talked about there's kind of two main types, but one of the models that I gave was that we have this ideal when God created everything good. And we live in a world, right, that for now it's because of sin, it's under a curse, right? And we're waiting for redemption. You think about Romans 8, it talks about how all creation is groaning under this curse. And when we look at curse, it affects many things, right? But it curses, we have sin cursed bodies. And so when we think about that, when we think about the role of medicine, or more specifically, these technologies, we want to think about that as a grid for, do these technologies allow us to kind of peel back or push back the curse, all the ways in which Jesus, when he performed his miracles, he talked about how many times it wasn't necessarily, he wasn't, when he healed the man that was born blind, it wasn't this man's sin or his parents' sin, it was that the glory of God might be revealed. So we're looking at, can these medical technologies help us to go back towards the ideal pattern, or are there sometimes when they are leading us more and more into more sinful situations? And so you guys remember, we talked about two types of artificial insemination. Do you remember what they were? Yeah, AIH and AID. And so just in summary, we were wrapping those things up and trying to determine if they were ever permissible, if they were ever good, are they ever not permissible. So can anyone want to summarize, which of those two do we think was usually more permissible or more in line with God's plan for childbearing? We might have to look back. The first one, right? So that the artificial insemination from the husband. So in this case, it's a husband and wife, and it's the husband's sperm is used to inseminate the egg of the wife. And so that ideal, right, is there's this, God created a man and wife, right, to form a marriage. And then, right, through that, and I could maybe add in, right, through marriage and then sexual union, produce children. And because of, in some cases, when a man and wife are unable to follow that pathway, sometimes artificial insemination can be used as a technology to allow a man and wife to be married, to maybe help them where there's sexual union that isn't producing children, to produce children. Okay. So that was a good example of where it could be something that could be ethically permissible, okay? And then, do you remember any times where we thought about maybe it wasn't helpful or wasn't used for God's ideal? Either with the AIH or the AID.
The AID, because that's the donor.
Yeah, so this is more complicated, right? So here, we have husband, we have and so what were some of the tricky situations that we talked about? Remember that we talked about it could create all different types of families other than this type. What were some of those? We talked about the octomom. Remember, she didn't have the traditional family setup. She had the eight implanted, and they all made it through, or actually she had six implanted. I think two of them split into twins. And so she had eight live birth and octuplets, but she's a single unmarried woman. So that was the breaking against. Okay. And then we also talked about how it can allow for same-sex couples to have children. Okay. And then we talked about, I think we were at, kind of at that point E where we were just looking at the assessment. So when in some of those cases, we would say probably that the AID is not really prudent or permissible. So we talk about that idea, permissible versus prudent. Right? We have this ideal, and there's some things that are less and less prudent, right? They may not be wise, but they're still approaching, right? And then you have this barrier where, right, permissible, right? So all the things that are permissible, some are more prudent than others. Some may be more wise, some may be less wise. And then underneath here, we have things that wouldn't be permissible. So those are sinful to varying degrees. So when we say, just making that distinction, right, there could be times where it's permissible, but maybe not be the best course of action. And so some of the examples of how it could be sinful, there could be a selfish desire to have children, greedy desires of the donor if they're donating just for the money or for the pride or the vanity. Circumstances like lesbian relationships would make it clearly wrong, but just because of that, it doesn't make it absolutely wrong. So I would say that there may be cases where AID could be permissible. And then AIH could be extremely helpful for couples. There are some circumstances where they talk about AID could be a benevolent act. So if you have a man who is donating his sperm so that an infertile married couple can conceive and have children, you may have a husband that they can't use his sperm, and you have a donor that's allowing their sperm to be used to so that that couple could bear children. Or it could be the husband not wanting to pass along a genetic defect. Okay. So Dave says, please don't take it as a ringing endorsement, but know that there are sufficient factors which could put it on the list as a possible way. Okay. So when you think about artificial insemination versus in vitro, right? That's what we're getting ready to talk about next, in vitro. What's the main difference? Yes. And I'm again making my disclaimer. I'm not a medical professional, so just with the limited research. But what's the key difference here in vitro?
Insemination versus an implanted egg.
Right. So when you got insemination, you're planting you're depositing the sperm, but the egg is still inside the inside the uterus. Whereas in vitro, right, the egg or eggs are removed, the sperm, everything's happening outside the woman's body. So that's a big key difference. And the other that brings up a few more differences too is that with in vitro, with AID, there's one egg that's being they're trying to inseminate, whereas with in vitro, many eggs can be collected. Okay, well, let's do a little background. So on July 25th, 1978, Louise Joy Brown was brought into the world to her proud parents, John and Leslie Brown. On account of Leslie's blocked fallopian tubes, the couple had tried unsuccessfully for 9 years to conceive a child of their own. Their fortunes changed when Leslie underwent a procedure performed by Patrick Steptoe and Robert Edwards to conceive the first, quote, test tube baby. Since then, in vitro fertilization has opened up numerous possibilities to the 1 in 6 couples who struggle with infertility. So in 2006, 54,656 children were successfully delivered through this technology. That's a lot to me.
Yeah.
54,000 in 1 year, a little over 10,000 per state. Okay, so with my limited technology and medical experience, we're going to try and walk through part A, which is the procedure. Okay, here we go. So what is it like? So IVF might be performed using the gametes of both the wife and the husband with donor semen or donor ova or with donor embryo. So it could be that the egg comes from the wife or a donor, and it could be that the sperm comes from the husband or a donor. So all of those are options. But
make a Punnett square.
And we could, this is the wife is a donor, and then this is, All right, and then we'll measure the... No. Okay. So in preparation for collection of the eggs, the woman is given hormones for 5 to 7 days to stimulate growth of the eggs in the follicles of her ovaries. Another hormone controls the exact time, 32 hours later, when the eggs are ready for removal. At that time, a small incision in the woman's navel is made, and a laparoscope, a long miniature microscope with a light, which allows the doctor to view the woman's internal organs and the collection of eggs, is inserted. Through another incision, forceps are used to hold the ovary in place, and a hollow needle is inserted to suck the egg from its follicle. If the egg is fully ripe and ejected before removal, or if it is not quite mature enough, it cannot be used. Once removed, the egg in follicular fluid is placed in a petri dish with a nutrient solution. After maturing for another 5 or 6 hours, it's exposed to about 100,000 sperm collected from the husband by masturbation. To increase the likelihood of success, several eggs are usually taken and fertilized in this fashion. The eggs develop into 4, 8, or 16 cell embryos. At whatever stage the doctor or doctors considers most advantageous, the embryos are transferred into a tube or catheter through the cervix into the uterus. If implantation takes place, the baby begins to develop in a normal manner. In order to maximize chances that at least one embryo will implant, the woman should remain in bed for about 18 hours. Whew. And so, and this, again, this happens over, it's not an all at once type deal. It happens over several days. It's a long, kind of a lengthy process. And so that's kind of, we'll work our way through. So, right, I'm not sure where to write this, but so we've got step one, right? There, usually we have one egg per cycle, right? We think about the ideal, you got one egg, right? And each during ovulation, that one egg has a chance of being fertilized. But over here, right, we have kind of a hormones. And what's the purpose of the hormones? It's to produce more eggs, okay? So many eggs. Okay, and then number two, right, they're collected. And only the ones that are appropriately mature can be used. So some, like they said, some are immature, overly mature, and they can't be, they don't even attempt to fertilize them, right? So then, all right, they're in the dish, petri dish, and the sperm is introduced, okay? And at that point, not every egg will be fertilized successfully. So some of them will, some of them won't, right? So at each stage, what's happening is you're losing eggs, okay? So let's say, for example, that you start with, you withdraw, so a lot of times it's 10 to 15 eggs. Not all of those eggs are going to be mature, okay? And so out of here, how many are mature? Maybe there's 9 of them. Then when the sperm is introduced, maybe there's half of them, right? So then you have fertilized eggs. Or embryos. And so maybe there's 4 or 5 of those, okay? So then there's a stage in which those kind of grow in the lab for like, could be 3 to 5 days, right? Where they examine, and out of those, they, whichever ones are the most viable and healthy, they choose how many to then implant, right? So then they implant, and at that point, you have the kind of the same beginnings of a fertilized egg in a normal pregnancy, where whether or not it makes it the whole way, there can be miscarriage, right? There can be all these things that can take place. And so each kind of this idea kind of helps us understand why so many eggs are collected, is that in vitro, every step of the way there's, they call it kind of an attrition. You're losing viable eggs, you're losing embryos. And so when you think about that process, right? I guess one question is, What are some of the concerns that you have in terms of how it might be used, where it might be ethical or unethical?
What do you do with unused fertilized eggs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good, so you're focusing in right once you get to here, right? So what do you do with them? Anybody know what are the options to a couple?
Freeze them.
Freeze them, yes, yeah. So, run out of room. So, yeah. When you look at embryos, there are anywhere from 4 to 6 options. Freeze them for what?
Future use.
Yeah, for future. So some couples, they, like Dave was saying, they when they're young, they freeze their eggs or embryos when they're not ready to start their family, and then they want to then thaw them out and have them 10 years, 15 years later. What else could they do?
Can they implant all of them?
So, like in the case that we talked about last time, they did. They implanted all of them. Oftentimes, during this, right, there's usually, again, there's some attrition, right? So they might implant 4, hoping that 1 or 2 will. And that's kind of a decision for the couple as well, because the doctor explains, we don't know how many of these will, and then there's kind of the moral, ethical cost. There's all these factors that, because they've gone through this process. And so it depends on what the mother and the father are wanting to do.
I think an ethical concern right off the bat is you're treating human lives like microwavable pizza, where it's just a devaluation of human worth, especially if, at this point, they are embryos. And sure, I guess hypothetically, you can use them in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems to put them in that position to begin with, especially if it's simply for the sake of personal commodity later,
mm-hmm.
or personal utility later,
mm-hmm.
Seems pretty selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, taking eggs and sperm out of the natural functioning of things,
mm-hmm.
and using them in a way that's unnatural and therefore leads to a higher risk of loss of life,
mm-hmm.
Because, like you said, there is attrition,
mm-hmm.
and so at this point they're embryos. We believe that conception, life,
mm-hmm.
And so because you're bringing life in multiple situations, but the hostile environment that you're kind of doing it in,
mm-hmm.
the possibility or a higher possibility,
mm-hmm.
of that death, I think you're taking purposeful risks,
mm-hmm.
That increase the damage that might be done, that put people in, or yeah, that put the embryos, that put the infants in the position of dying that they probably wouldn't be in otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so we celebrate all life, but also when you're bringing life in a way that also immediately puts that life in danger when it might not otherwise have been,
mm-hmm.
so is deeply, deeply,
yeah.
concerning.
Yeah, those are great points. I think a couple of the things that I thought you'd point out was like the danger, like taking risk. Some of the numbers are like, and I think you made a good distinction that you made as well, is that like we consider them human, right? We consider them people. At a very early stage, as soon as they are the fertilized egg, right? And so, morally and ethically, we may consider choices here differently than we consider the choices here as to what to do with sperm, what to do with these unfertilized eggs. They say that only about 75% of the collected eggs are generally mature enough, and out of those that 9, about 70 to 80% will become fertilized, and then during development, like how many of them make it to this embryonic stage that they could possibly be implanted? That's somewhere around 50%. And then in terms of how many of them may make it to the final implantation, there's maybe another, I I think 50% or so. And so you can see how you're it's a lot of times it is treated as a game of numbers, that if they want to have one or two births, they think we have to start with a large number of eggs, and oftentimes a larger number of embryos, knowing that it's not the ideal situation. And I think that the statistic is that over the entire process, per cycle, it's around 40 to 50% of the cases actually result in a live birth. So no matter how many eggs they start with, less than half, after going through this whole process, result in the live birth of a child. And so around half of them, all through this process, there's no baby is born at the end of that. So there is it's not the ideal situation.
So you said 50% of the 50% are...
Right, it keeps getting cut in half. So in these two. So, and you think about, say you have these fertilized eggs and they're watching them grow from one cell to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16. And about 50% of those aren't, they kind of die on their own in a sense. They're not necessarily disposed of. And so I think that is one area where, if you think about Christians who are seeking to have their own children, there is probably a distinction between attempting to preserve all the fertilized eggs, all the embryos, to either save them or implant them, and then die on their own. I think that the question is, you know, how much risk is morally acceptable? In other words, if you're, I think, because you said, you know, how much risk is too much risk for these, like, for these embryos, because there's a large chance that we're knowingly going to lose some of those embryos in the process.
It just seems like if you're going to lose 50% of all that life, seems like too much risk. Like,
mm-hmm.
Because yes, they die on their own, but they die on their own because you put them in that situation.
Yeah, what do you guys think? Is that too much risk, Eric?
I guess I'm trying to think of this in the context of, you know, especially when the Bible was written, how
mm-hmm.
risky it was to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, kind of two competing thoughts in my mind, in the sense that in one sense, they tried to have children because it was a game of numbers.
Right.
That you were going to lose children,
mm-hmm.
and you were trying to survive.
Mm-hmm. And many times you had to have, you know, 15 pregnancies to have two or three children to raise to adult.
Right. And you knew that there was a potential for that, and that there was also risk to the life of the mother. But was that risk going to be outweighed by the potential for having a child,
mm-hmm.
In that context? The other sense, when I look at, like, sort of the ethics of, you know, utilizing the technology we have today, we have an ethic that is kind of in along the lanes, you know, in a different category of, like, no child left behind, in a
mm-hmm.
sense, the bad use of the term, but, like,
right.
That is kind of the moral ethical standpoint, is, like, we have an ethical moral choice to do everything we can from a medical standpoint to save the children,
mm-hmm.
once we have the capability. And so those two kind of I wrestle with,
mm-hmm.
you know, now in the application of this, because it's sort of, you're taking the process out of what God designed.
Mm-hmm.
And are we deeming this to be a process that we designed, or God is, you know, supporting? Because
mm-hmm.
I think both, in the sense, we're sort of a game of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have this ethical, moral obligation to do everything we can to increase those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know kind of what the Bible says about this process change.
Yeah, let's take a minute. Let's read one scripture that's very very commonly referred to. So let's go to Psalm 139. It's there on page 7 for you. Anybody want to read, volunteer, Psalm 139, 13 to 16?
Thank you.
Go for it.
For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful all your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, mm-hmm. when as yet there was not one of them.
Yeah. And so this verse, along with the following two, point to that question, how should we regard the embryo? Right. So what is our regard for the embryos? What is it?
Human life.
Yeah, it's human life. And it's interesting, I was reading a lot of articles about, so as Andy mentioned, many of these embryos can be frozen, and for future use, they can be implanted. They can also be donated, right? Few different things. What are some ways that they could be donated? What are some reasons they could be donated? Or where could they be donated to?
Isn't there an adoption program for
them? Yeah. Yeah. So, now, legally, right now the U.S. considers embryos as property. They're not considered human life. And that's a distinction. So legally, in most cases, there's some sort of written consent form that I am donating this. And in some of the articles that I read, they were very clear to say, oh, it's not really adoption. That's the wrong term to be using. Because Christians mostly are the ones that call it, you know, this is a, sometimes they call them snowflake adoptions, right? And so there's this view from the world that they're very reluctant to refer to it as adoption because they want them to be treated as it's genetic material. It's property. It's not a human life. So there's, they can be donated for adoption by other couples. So I thought I'd read to you guys. This is one, kind of a story I read where it says born. So in 1992. Two babies who were born to Rachel and Philip Ridgway were frozen as embryos. But on October of 31st of 2022, they gave birth to them. So they're frozen for, now in my mind, 92 to 22 is 30 years, is that right? And so I don't know where they're doing the math. They say, I'm sorry. The article is written in 22, but they were born in 2020. So 28 years. And so they said, it's something mind-boggling about it, Philip Ridgway said as he and his wife cradled their newborns in their laps. I was 5 years old when God gave life to Lydia and Timothy, and he's been preserving that life ever since. In a sense, they're our oldest children, even though they're our smallest children. The embryos were created for an anonymous married couple using in vitro fertilization. The husband was in his early 50s, and they used a 34-year-old egg donor. The embryos were frozen in April of 1992. For nearly three decades, they sat in storage on tiny straws kept in liquid nitrogen at nearly 200 degrees below zero in a device that looks much like a propane tank. They were kept in a fertility lab on the West Coast until 2007, when the couple who created them donated them to the National Embryo Donation Center in Knoxville, Tennessee, in hopes that another couple might be able to use them. And so the article talks about how it's a Christian organization that I think created this donor or embryo donation place in hopes that people who had frozen embryos who were not going to use them, were maybe going to dispose of them, that they could donate them and that other people could adopt them, right? You can use that term. So that's one good. What's something that maybe people might donate their embryos to that would not be maybe a good option?
Science.
Yeah, science and research. Right? Oftentimes they're going to research looking at stem cells and all kinds of different things. And we'll get into stem cells as we get further along. So I guess one distinction to ask is, you get kind of brought up, Eric, is, you know, in this cycle, you have sometimes in between here, we have spontaneous abortion or miscarriage. Right, so what's the difference between fertilized embryos that are lost, that don't make it to maturity and birth, versus fertilized embryos that are lost here? What do we think is it, what differences would you draw?
Can you explain spontaneous abortion real quick?
Well, I would just maybe call it a miscarriage would be better.
Okay.
Better trauma. Just clarify. Yeah. Because in both cases you have, let's say, take the ideal case, it's a husband and wife, they're seeking to have a child, they get pregnant and then they miscarry, or over here they do in vitro, and they get some fertilized eggs, but they don't implant, they're lost. What would be maybe differences that you would draw, if any?
One's naturally occurring, where the other is a product of scientific intervention.
Yeah. So there's this idea of. And what do we, if you look back at Psalm 139, what do we see as a description of the process, right? In general, how does the psalmist describe the process?
The Lord forming.
The Lord is doing the forming. And where is it happening? Yeah, in the mother's womb. And so that's, some people would draw, right, a distinction by saying that once you take everything out of the mother's womb, it becomes much more, right, your amount of risk goes much higher. Okay? So here it's happening in the womb versus over here, you're in a petri dish. Okay? And so it does bring, a lot of it comes back to risk. Right? At what stage is risk acceptable, right? And at what stage is it such a high amount that you can expect? So what do you think? If you're doing this procedure and they say there's probably a 90% chance that some of the fertilized embryos will not survive, what do you think? Is that an acceptable? See some heads. What do you think, Amberly?
I don't think so, because the chance of them not surviving is greater than the chance of them surviving.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so risky. It's like you're creating these children. It's like putting your newborn in a car without the car seat, right? And you're driving at 100 miles an hour down the right? You're taking these crazy risks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it any riskier than someone that's had several miscarriages and then has a baby on the fourth one?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Do you know what the percentage of of just miscarriages in general are of pregnancy?
That's really, I've tried really hard to find that number. It's extremely hard to measure. Right? But let's say, for example, that the rate of pregnancies that end in miscarriage, in miscarriage was 30%, just make up a number, and this was 35%, right? If they're similar, that might change your discussion. Anybody know, anybody have an idea of rate of miscarriage?
I've heard it's 1 in 4, 1 in 5.
1 in 4, 1 in 5, 20-25%.
Does it come down to the knowledge, right? Like, you know that when you're going to try to have a baby that there's that chance, and some people have learned that they have a higher chance, and so I'm sure it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Those women that have that situation, but and the other, you know, we're knowing, right, like, the example you gave, if that's true, like you're knowing that you're only giving those a 90% chance. It's, you know what I'm saying? Like we don't we don't know what's going to happen. God is the giver.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
When we try to create a baby the way he created
mm-hmm.
us to have a baby, we know that there's that chance.
Yeah.
We don't know what's going to happen. And the other, like, you can help narrow it down to
mm-hmm.
a percentage, and you know that.
Yeah.
You know you're taking that percentage of risk. Does it come down to that?
So, there is a, yeah, when you say no, it's kind of a subjective term in the sense that there's
right.
to the best of our knowledge, right, but we're never certain, again, what will happen. And percentages never really tell the whole picture of what's exactly going to happen. And I think when we talk about this, when you talk about these kind of issues, we're in this discussion, right, thinking about ethics. We're in the prudent. Is it prudent to do it? Is it wise? Okay. But we also still want to know, like, where, at what line is it not even permissible, right? Are there any times? Yeah.
What kind of baffles me is why we're considering it okay to this point when it is all man-controlled and this is all God-controlled. I mean, God may, we don't know, maybe God's got his hand in this other, but if at some point this becomes us manipulating, but you can manipulate within woman's
yeah.
married nature and carrying a baby too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can help that child or manipulate things medically. So either we throw the whole thing out because you can't say at this point it's okay and at this point it's not okay. Because if we're going to have that process, you know, people are going to take it as far as they can,
mm-hmm.
you know, to either make it work or not. So either we say the whole thing is wrong and only nature can decide whether you can carry that baby or not, or we have to say, okay, then we have to accept it as okay. Right? It's either right or wrong, right? It can't be gray.
So I think
well, okay, let's respond to that. So you're, just to make sure, so you're saying that either the medical approach, it's either always wrong or always right?
Well,
or,
yeah. If,
like if we can use...
Because people are going to go with it to the very final point. Like, I know someone who's going through this. She
mm-hmm.
has a very, very hard time carrying a fertilized egg. So they have gone into this. And they've had one child successfully with this. But usually, even with multiple eggs, they're lucky to get one.
Mm-hmm.
One.
Mm-hmm.
So do we say it's okay then? But everybody else, because this is a possibility, we use it for whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
It is.
I think one really good thing that you're bringing out is that the technology itself is not... I think necessarily it's a means to men and women carrying out actions. And those actions, when you think about having children, there are godly ways that God wants us to have children. And there are ungodly ways. So let's take the technology out, right? Children, you can have unmarried couples having children, right? You can have extramarital affairs that result in children. You can have rape that results in children. You can have incest that results in children. And so you have all these sinful ways in which children are produced. And then you have God's ideal way, which is through the husband and wife creating the child, raising them, loving them. And when we think about technology, it's a tool, and we have to ask that same question. Is there a way this tool can be used to create children in a godly way? Is it going to be used to create children in an ungodly or sinful way? Is it always one or the other, or is it ever time, or is there a time where it's permissible at all, right? Or is it not never going to be permissible? That's kind of the question that we're asking. Because the technology is the tools that we're using. Same thing as we talk about with birth control. Is there ever a permissible time to use birth control? And when we talked about abortion, is there ever permissible times? And so each of those issues, the question is not necessarily about the technology. It's about how it can be used or should be used or when it could be. Does that kind of help make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when you're talking about these percentages and prudence, that's a separate conversation for us than whether or not it's morally right and wrong, right? If we take a single father or single mother and they just want to create a child outside of, you know, having a husband or wife, that's not God's design. Or if we have a gay couple, so homosexual women or lesbian women, that's not God's design. And so it's not that the technology is sinful itself, it's just that we're using them to create children.
But as soon as that child or the egg is successfully fertilized and it is an embryo,
yes,
God is in the plan.
Right.
And that child, that human, is known by God.
Right. And so at that point, our decision is then how do we interact? And that's a big difference, because when you think about technologies, there's Christians who are considering whether or not to create, to try and create an embryo, right? So that's before, that's one decision. Then there's Christians in the church that have to deal with, let's say that we have done this, and we have all of these frozen embryos, what do we now do with them, right? So that's a separate decision that we're thinking about.
I think a major... I'm still stuck on the mortality rate, and I think that a major concern for me is we look at the concept of active intent or mens rea. And so at the very least, from a legal perspective, if you're operating a vehicle,
mm-hmm.
and let's say it's you're on a job site and you're operating a crane, and a tragedy happens and people die,
mm-hmm.
that is a tragedy. And generally speaking, people would not be held liable for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you then get into this crane and knowing that you've not taken care of it, that it's rusty, that it's falling apart,
mm-hmm.
or if you just purposefully drop a bunch
yeah.
of things on people,
yeah.
well, then you had the active intent to possibly kill
mm-hmm.
people. And
mm-hmm.
so you are held liable for that. So I think ultimately the difference that I've come down to, at least in my mind, and obviously we don't want to compare people to things,
sure,
right?
Sure.
But the comparison or the difference that I've come down to is that in the case of unfortunately you have a naturally existing child who unfortunately passed away, then that is a tragedy, and
mm-hmm.
there was no intent. But
mm-hmm.
what you do when you do this is you actively subject life to death. You do this knowing that some will die.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the mens rea. It's the mental active intent. It's the knowledge of going through with this action despite knowing that there will be death.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're still going through with it. Now,
mm-hmm.
with the embryos that are already frozen, obviously, right, that's different. Like, how do we remedy a simple broken thing?
Yeah.
But ultimately, what it comes down to for me is you know that there will be death. You know that you are subjecting human life to end by
mm-hmm.
doing this, and yet you're still going through with it. As opposed to, there is a possibility of a tragedy happening,
mm-hmm.
but that... Yeah, does that make sense?
I think so. I think that you're maybe imputing some intention in terms of what their expectation is.
Sure.
A question I would ask on that is, what percentage of potential loss deems it to be the intent? Because all pregnancies have a percentage of loss.
That's
and so
true.
So there's a your argument is that there's a percentage line that you draw. Once it's over that percentage, then it's intent for wrong.
Sure.
Which, so then what's the percentage?
Okay, so mm-hmm. let's talk at, okay, go ahead.
It just seems, especially when we discuss a process that's outside the body,
mm-hmm.
and also discussing it in terms of like laboratory results or numbers, there's a desensitizing to the fact that it's human life.
Yeah.
And when you desensitize, I think you look at it, you know, you compare cultures. You know, Nazi Germany had an amazing way to desensitize themselves for what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
because they went through the motions to be able to take care of people in a way that seemed scientifically accurate in terms of handling things in a way that was mm-hmm. sort of human controlled.
Yeah.
And so it's that desensitization, I think, that when we remove our hearts from that process, then I think it borderlines getting into that
yeah.
not acceptable.
All right, Judy's waving at me.
That's kind of my train of thought, because what if
probably in this room, because I was born just shortly after World War II started. And what if some idiot, for lack of a better word, like Hitler, would get a hold of this knowledge? They could use it to genetically create their own.
Yeah, we're getting
what
there.
They call perfect
plans. Yeah, yeah,
so
we're getting
are
there.
So you're saying throw the whole thing out?
Well, yeah. So, okay, to get this in your mind for next week, what I want to do is read through. There's nine key kind of objections. All right, nine objections. So we've talked about a few of them kind of indirectly, but or questions. So number one, this is on back on page six. Does IVF allow men and women to play God? Number two, does IVF violate God's design for parenthood? Right, that's a good question. Number three, does IVF waste embryos, right? Does it waste or dispose of embryos? Number four, what is the fate of the embryos, right? What are the different outcomes that they could endure? Number five, IVF poses too much risk to the embryo or the baby, even if it's successful, which is one that we've kind of focused on here for a minute. Number six, IVF subjects embryos and babies to medical experiments involuntarily, so there's no consent given by the child. Number seven, IVF runs contrary to the traditional medical or medicine's vow to heal, right, in terms of what happens with the embryos. All right, so if you think about, those are kind of the main ethical questions that people bring when they, and concerns, when they think about IVF, those are some of the main seven. And so as we, what we'll do is probably next time we'll start with just looking at those, which one of those do you think is really the most valid, most concerning to you? Do you have any responses biblically to those questions? Are we playing God when we use IVF? Is there too much risk? Are the babies being subjected to something that's excessive or involuntary experimentation? And we'll kind of look at our assessment of IVF when we come back next time. But as you can see, there's lots and lots of concerns when you look at it. Yeah. And we're dealing with technology that, again, we haven't had. And it continues to grow even more and more. And we haven't even gotten to, you mentioned there's now, you know, gene editing that can be done, human cloning. So there's plenty of other things. Now let me close our time with prayer. Father, I thank you for, first of all, just the gift that you've given us, that you've made us in your image. You've given us minds. You've made us to be creative, to be productive. But also, God, we live in a world where we're just suffering under the curse of sin. Each of us is born sinful and just depraved, in that every aspect of our mind, our thoughts, our actions are cursed. And so we pray, as we talk about man's abilities as they grow through his scientific knowledge and these medical technologies, give us great wisdom to help to understand what can sometimes be many, many issues tangled up together. Help us to sort them out, to look through them, to determine where things may be permissible and where they are not permissible, where they could be used to restore something that is cursed and to redeem something from what is broken, but also help us to know where we are taking excessive risk, where we are even killing those fertilized eggs, those embryos that were made in your image. And help us to know, and give us great wisdom as we think about, just as people who will interact throughout our lifetime in our own lives, in our own marriages, and with many friends and people that we've talked about here that we know that struggle with having children. Help us to know how to give good counsel as we look to thinking about this. I give you thanks in your name. Pray that you be with us as we worship you the rest of this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.